This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is January 28, 2009. This is the second session with Howard Martin, Emeritus Dean of UW Extension and Continuing Studies. No, go ahead, Howard.
It's Emeritus Dean of Division of Continuing Studies, not Extension.
Continuing Studies. And I think that mistake of mine indicates probably some of the confusion that exists to this day. Howard, maybe we could start with your laying out the distinction between extension and continuing studies.
All right. The University of Wisconsin-Madison, as it's called now, originally in the very early part of the 20th century, had a university extension division, which was part and parcel of the Madison campus, and remained so until the 1960s. And as several books and theses will indicate and authenticate what I'm saying, it was one of the most prominent university extension divisions in the country, and in fact in the whole world. And it was a reflection of the commitment to the Wisconsin idea and to what is commonly known these days as the open university concept. Early on, president of the university, Van Hise, in his expression of the Wisconsin idea, talked about the university reaching in the boundaries of the state and the beneficent influence of the university going into every home. Well, that's what Madison committed itself, and the arm for that was the Extension Division. And in fact, many of the academic departments on the campus in the schools and colleges had faculty and staff on their roster, so to speak, dedicated to carrying out this extension function. Well, as I mentioned, the Extension Division remained part of the UW-Madison until the 1960s. And under its auspices was the outgrowth of the university centers, now known as the UW Colleges. Well, in the mid-1960s, the president of the university at that time decided to create or change the name of Extension Division into University Extension with its own chancellor. And I believe the first chancellor was Donald McNeil. This, in a sense, created a separate separate institution, and then upon the merger of the Wisconsin State University system and the University of Wisconsin and its satellites, for want of a better term, Green Bay, Parkside, Milwaukee, and the two-year centers. Work made into a totally separate institution, in which agricultural extension, cooperative extension, that is, general extension, dealing with non-agricultural subjects. The Wisconsin Radio and Television, Wisconsin Public Radio and Television, were all put into what was then called University of Wisconsin Extension, which still exists today. That happened during the time of the merger of the two university systems. So from that time until the mid-1980s, University of Wisconsin Extension was a separate, freestanding component of the UW system. In the early 80s, there was concern expressed that Madison, the University of Wisconsin Madison, had lost its extension arm. It was unable to carry out the extension mission, the land grant mission, to the extent that it was mandated to. And with influence from the Board of Visitors to Chancellor Irving Shane, the case was made to the Regents to revisit the issue of returning extension function to the Madison campus. After a period of about 4 years, from about 1981 to 1985, negotiations were underway. Not only between Madison and UW Extension, but between among the other universities and UW Extension. And in 1985, a complete agreement was reached to reintegrate the faculty of UW Extension, which had been freestanding for couple of decades or more into the UW Madison. The vast majority, overwhelming majority of those faculty were Madison based. A few were Milwaukee based, and those people integrated into the UW Milwaukee. that time the exact amount I can't remember. It was probably close to 400. The faculty and staff were in a slight majority affiliated with the departments of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Of course, because Madison had the largest College of Agriculture and Life Sciences in the entire system. But there were also a couple hundred affiliated with the professional schools, engineering, nursing, medical school, education, etc., etc. And as of July 1985, these faculty and their accompanying staff, academic and classified, became fully fledged members of the Madison campus and its faculty, etc.
Was this a good development, Howard?
Yes, particularly in the fact that it brought the majority of people closer to more closely to the research base of the campus. There is probably some controversy as to the financial arrangement and the fact that UW Extension remained as a separate entity with very close ties and control on the agricultural cooperative extension side. That area is one that created some antagonism. At the same time, as many people don't realize, the general extension faculty, the people in fields such as mine, German, Scandinavian studies, and mathematics, in the arts and the social sciences, were not supported fully by general purpose revenue, but in fact had an income responsibility which has grown over the years. In other words, they were on a program revenue basis with a minimal amount of GPR support. Mm. And in order to support their staff, to support their expenses, they had to create programs, classes, etc., to generate money, and were not supported to the same extent as the resident faculty in the academic departments.
Hi. You ready?
So in 1985, on the Madison campus was created I have to correct myself. So prior to 1985, in anticipation of this merger, this integration, a division of university outreach was created on the Madison campus. The division of university outreach became the precursor of the division of continuous studies. I'll say a little bit more about the emergence of the division of continuous studies later. And division of university outreach at that time in the 1983, 1984 to 1985 was in charge of the reintegration of the programs and personnel from extension into the campus. It led the campus-based effort on behalf of Chancellor Shane, working with Extension, Chancellor Boyle of Extension, and I was his main faculty representative in the negotiations. In 1985, when the integration took place in its final form, so to speak, the extension activities based in Madison became part and parcel, once again, after a long history, of the Madison campus mission. And the mission of that division, the Division of University Outreach and its dean, was to carry out the continuing education public service mission of UW-Madison in reaching out to non-traditional students and the people of the state and beyond. And that in itself was a return, so to speak, of what had become the agent of the Wisconsin idea to the Madison campus.
And yeah, let me get this on tape. So Howard, from your perspective, this was a good development.
It was a good development, although it's still a process after 20 years that's underway because there've been so many other influences on the campus in terms of economic setbacks and acceptance of the extension function as a legitimate function of every department. But nevertheless, it returns the extension function, the continuing education function, the public service function, back solidly to the campus. And it's fairly clear, at least to me, in 2009, that there is a recognition that the Wisconsin idea and its performance is an important factor in the university's existence.
So Howard, this means, for instance, let's take the Department of German. There is now within the Department of German some faculty who are working in the extension role?
Not in the sense that there's anybody based there. As far as I can see, it manifests itself in the programs and activities of the Max Carter Institute, which is affiliated with the German department. Mm-hmm. Although there are no faculty or staff in the department themselves that are dedicated to the extension function. That's just the case in German. It's the case in many other departments in the College of Letters and Science. On the other hand, in the School of Nursing, there are dedicated people. In Library and Information Studies, there are dedicated people to this function. In engineering and in engineering professional development, there are more than a few. There's the same thing in executive education, and in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, almost every department has somebody with an extension or part of their appointment on extension duties.
So following this merger in 1985, for instance, your tenure home becomes the Department of German.
No. Some departments within extension or groups of people moved over. Did not move directly into the departments. That number right now is very small compared to when the merger took place, or the integration took place.
Mm-hmm. So after 1985, where are you? What are you working on?
In 1985, In 1985, I was the chair, when I moved to the Madison campus, I was the chair of the department called Liberal Studies, which moved lock, stock, and barrel from Extension onto the Madison campus. And its major responsibilities were evening courses in the foreign languages and the liberal arts in general, along with responsibility for, at that time, a very large independent study activities, which were formerly correspondence studies, but were moving slowly but surely to online formats, etc., etc., audio formats at first. But they had the responsibility for what had historically been known as the correspondence study program of the university. And they were based predominantly with the liberal studies folks. Anything from English, French, German, Norwegian, mathematics, psychology, history, all of the so-called distance ed courses at that time.
Mm-hmm. So, so where are you housed at this time?
Well, at first we were housed in Lowell Hall on Langdon Street. It's now known as Lowell Center, and we had moved from Extension Division to from the Extension Building on Lake Street to Lowell Hall, and yes, Lowell Hall.
And so, Howard, how long are you in this position of chair of liberal studies?
I don't recall exactly, but in 1987, I was named dean of the Division of University Outreach on the Madison campus. And at that time, I was a half-time appointment, plus a 10% affiliated with what was called the Office of Outreach and Outreach Development on the Madison campus under Associate Vice Chancellor Joe Corey, and the rest of my time was spent teaching, and I was teaching German for graduate students and also some of the higher level correspondence courses in German.
Now, for the record, how did you become dean? Were you asked to serve? Were you aspiring to administrative leadership?
No, I didn't aspire to a position like that on the Madison campus. I was nominated, and for the position, and went through the interview process, and was offered the job, and I accepted it, and started in August of 1987.
So, and you're working for Joe Corey at this point?
No, I'm working for the provost of I'm working for the Madison campus, theoretically for the chancellor.
Okay.
And
tell me again, this you're dean of university outreach.
Right, I succeeded Bryant Curl, who had been dean of university outreach for about 2 years prior to my being born. And he retired. There was a search, along with the faculty committee, etc., and a faculty academic staff committee. Mm-hmm. And I emerged as one of the top candidates. I don't know how many finalists there were. Mm-hmm. I know there were at least two. Was a dean on the Madison campus.
Mm-hmm. And based in Lowell.
I was based in Lowell Hall. I also had an office in Bascom Hall. Because I kept my base in Lowell Hall because I was still teaching out of there, but I was also working out of Bascom along with people in Joe Corey's office, and I was on the Dean's Council.
Okay, and so this is Irv Shane is still chancellor, or is Bernie Korn?
No, Bernie Korn is now acting chancellor or interim chancellor. I don't recall what name he had. Mm-hmm. And the search was on the way, and they'd already identified the successor, and the successor was Donna Shalala. I started in August. And shortly after I started, Mary Rouse started as the new Dean of Students. And then a couple of months after that, Donna Shalala arrived to be Chancellor.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you what you thought of her and what your relationship with her was like?
Well, it's... she was new, I was new, and day-to-day operations, it's been my experience that not really none of the chancellors interfere with you. You're hired to do a job. They call upon you when they feel that there's some need to be addressed. I can recall very few instances where I had one-on-one meetings with Donna. All I remember is that if she had a new idea that dealt with, let's say, senior citizens, she would talk to me and ask me what I thought, and I learned very quickly that with Donna, if an idea had any kind of validity, you gave it a shot. You didn't say, "Well, we don't do that kind of thing at this university." I got along with her fine socially, but I didn't mix with her very much. As I would say, the number of times that I spoke to her one-on-one, where I was asked to her office for advice or to get some kind of instruction on something, was less than six. In the time that she was here.
Would you say that she was pretty supportive of the concept of university outreach?
Yeah, I never had any interference in doing what I thought were the best things for the division and its affiliates. But that said, I feel that's been the case with all the chancellors under whom I've served. Shalala, David Ward, and John Wiley. All of them more or less have gave me free rein. And I felt comfortable with all three of them, and was never, how can I put it? Never hesitated to speak to them if I had a concern or an idea.
Mm-hmm. So when you take over as dean in August of 1987, what are the biggest challenges or problems that you're facing?
The biggest challenge was to further integrate the people in the general extension type of activity. That is in the arts and the social sciences, further into the schools and colleges to develop joint appointments, people who would have both resident instruction as well as extension type instruction. In other words, instruction at non-traditional hours to non-traditional audiences away from campus and away from campus. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, but to reach out and to develop the development of relationships with the residence departments, some of which had long lost the tradition of reaching out. That was the biggest challenge. And in fact, 20 years later, it was still a challenge in a few cases. Mm-hmm. But as I have intimated before, in integrating into the professional schools, putting the faculty and staff affiliated with the professional activities of the university was far easier than in traditional humanities, arts, and social science departments.
And what made it difficult, so difficult, with the humanities and the others, the arts, and so forth?
Well, in some cases, the academic qualifications would not fit the mold that most of the departments, let's say in letters and science, had set for themselves. There were people teaching in extension who had not got PhDs, even though they might have sterling teaching records, and their life had been spent teaching more than doing research. And in fact, because of their program revenue responsibilities, they'd not been able to acquire the time to do research. Other cases were the departments did not accept experience that was outside of the academy. People trained, let's say, in industry or in the retail world, what have you, mm-hmm. Were not seen as faculty types, so to speak. And then in some cases, legitimately, is that departments were already suffering economic setbacks and did not have the money or the positions in which to develop joint positions. Mm-hmm. So the success was partial. In some cases it worked, in other cases there were things working against it.
Mm-hmm. Howard, can you talk about any specific departments where it went well and departments where it didn't go well?
Well, it went well with the English department. It went well originally with the history department. Mm-hmm. But in the foreign languages, there was minimal success. In fact, I think that except for my being accepted into the Scandinavian Studies Department and being a fully fledged member of their executive committee, it didn't happen in the foreign languages. It didn't happen in social work. It didn't happen in a couple of others. It didn't happen in political science. It did happen in mathematics, but that relationship was severed several years later by for whatever reason. But the economic situation of the university, the tightness of money and positions, became a detriment to the further integration of the faculty. All right, so that was a challenge. At the same time, continuing education, generally speaking, on the Madison campus, not only because it had had a fairly firm setting or a firm foot, shall I say, in Madison environment, but overall, financially, it was sound. And when I left in early 2008, the continuing education budget, almost entirely across almost the entire campus, with a few exceptions, was very fiscally sound. The people of the state and even from outside of the state had kept up a pretty steady enrollment, enabling the departments to generate the program revenue to create this sound footing for the continuing education function on campus.
Howard, when you're working on the integration, are you working particularly closely with the dean of LNS?
No, I'm sure the deans of the schools and colleges were involved involved with the provost and the chancellor's office on the Madison campus, but I was working from 1983 or just before closely with the Chancellor of Extension and with Joe Corey and Bri Curl of the Madison campus, who were representing Chancellor Shane. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there were committees, and I mentioned last time there was a joint integration committee among the faculty and staff between the two university entities. There had been a system committee, PAGE, the President's Advisory Group on Extension, to come up with the overall plan for the system. I was involved in both of those, but in the actual day-to-day or week-to-week negotiations, I didn't work directly with the deans. Once I became dean on the Madison campus, then obviously I had the responsibility of working with the individual deans on areas where we wanted to bring about further integration. But much of what we set out to do had already been accomplished by July of 1987.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, from university outreach, when does it become formally known as continuing studies?
Well, in 1993, prior to 1993, the year before, Dean Harland Sampson, the Dean of Division of Summer Sessions and Intercollege Programs, decided to retire. And sometime in that year, the end of 1992, David Ward asked me, and I don't know what the process was or anything, but asked me if I would be interested in assuming responsibility for the division of university of summer sessions and intercollege programs. So, as I said, I'd been a half-time dean of university outreach, and I've been half-time in teaching. At that time, I jumped at the opportunity. I'd already put in a good few years, and I needed a challenge. There'd been other overtures made to me from outside of Madison. I had always been interested in summer sessions and the intercollege programs activity where one worked with adult students, special students, students outside the mainstream, so to speak, was a nice fit with university outreach. Mm-hmm. So in the summer of July of 1993, I became the dean of the Division of University Outreach and the Division of Summer Sessions and Intercollege Programs, which is, you can tell, quite a mouthful. Yes. And it brought together a lot of what people had thought as disparate or discrete activities under one roof, but there were a lot of nice fits, because summer session, in addition to serving regular students, also serves lots of special audiences. Teachers coming back, specialists in certain fields just coming back, people who come in as special students and not necessarily matriculated students. And they're of all ages and from different walks of life. So it's a nice fit with the whole university outreach concept. At that time, I and my staff felt that what we needed to do was to create a unified division, not two separate divisions, but a unified whole that would be easily recognizable to many folks in academia around the country. It wasn't a new name. It's different from continuing education because it's more than continuing education. It's dealing with diverse populations, people who are continuing a course of study for different reasons. And there were some models such as Nebraska and Stanford views where the term continuous studies was used. So we set the process going to rename these two divisions with the name Division of Continuing Studies. And I don't recall exactly which year that took place, but we received approval through all the different levels to undertake that, to take on that name. And sometime in the 1990s, that came into effect.
Now, you mentioned you'd always been interested in summer school or the summer sessions. What were the issues, if any, that you had to deal with when you now became responsible for the summer sessions as well?
Well, I don't recall any major issues. other than summer school had undergone some financial cuts, and it had the whole system wide. But UW-Madison, just as it had created an extension division in the early part of the 20th century, it also dedicated itself to providing a summer session or a set of summer sessions. So rather than an issue, I felt that my job was to maintain this solid summer session or set of summer sessions that Madison had and had become well known for. And for the 20 years that I, or for the 15 years or so that I served as kind of the dean of summer sessions, that was one of my greatest rewards, in that we were able to maintain a strong, balanced summer session across the entire campus. I don't think that, with the exception of the School of Veterinary Medicine, which was funded on an annual basis other than the other schools and colleges, we had a foot in and a working relationship with all of the schools and colleges, and all were involved in the offering of both graduate and undergraduate courses in the summertime. So that was a challenge, and if we want to use that word, but it was also a pleasure. And I believe that as of now, as we speak right now, that UW-Madison has one of the soundest, most curricularly balanced summer sessions in North America.
Did you ever have trouble getting faculty to teach in the summer?
No. It wasn't a rule, but one of the aims was not only to have a balanced curriculum, but also to have faculty instructional staff makeup in the summer as close to that of the regular year as possible. Given that that UW-Madison is one of few universities around the country that pays a percentage of the academic year base, given that this pay contributes to the retirement fund, we have never run into difficulty finding faculty and academic staff to teach in the summertime.
How many summer sessions are there?
Well, on paper, there are probably over 100, but in actual fact, what takes place is probably in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But as I suggested, it not only serves the regular undergraduate and graduate body, and the majority of students in the summer are undergraduates, but 20% of the students in the summer are from outside and are in special groups. And special groups, excuse me, special groups required teaching at special times. Mm-hmm. And We kind of had the, not kind of, we definitely did have the philosophy that we should, that we were here to serve, and that we should try to accommodate special groups. So for instance, if I mean, let's put it this way. The vast majority of people in summer attend the 2 4-week sessions and the 8-week session. That's where the bulk of the people are. And there, the dates for those are prescribed. But there are special groups that wish to come in that are not necessarily going to fit an 8-week session. So, for instance, if we have a contract with the Southeast Asian Studies Institute, which moves around from university to university, but sometimes for 3 to 5 year periods, they require, because it's mostly intensive foreign language courses, 10-week sessions. So a 10-week session is created to accommodate those people who are coming from all around the country and all around the world, so to speak. If there's a special course that zeroes in on one of our faculty specialties, let's say poultry science, which is done with a consortium of other Midwestern universities, that has a separate week or two. The Advanced Placement Institute for teachers that reaches out to 150 or more teachers, mostly from Wisconsin in the summertime, has a special session which immediately follows the ending of school in Wisconsin, the ending of the regular school year in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Because after all, teachers usually go back to work in mid-August in Wisconsin, and often they want to have another job during the months, during the weeks before they go back to their teaching job. Mm-hmm. So in order to accommodate to them, there's also another special session. So we've been in the time I and my colleagues are running such a summer session, we were very flexible and tried to accommodate student needs and special group needs in the summertime.
Now, I'm familiar a little bit with the music clinic that the School of Music does. Did that fall under your purview as well?
Well, originally it didn't, but it did come over to the to us, both administratively as well as administratively, it did come over to us. Originally, it was tied to the School of Music and Letters and Science. But then later on, and I don't remember how many years, but it's probably well over half a dozen as we speak right now, it was also moved administratively over to the division.
And was that for reasons of efficiency?
I don't recall exactly. I suspect that because the summer music clinic is predominantly a program revenue-driven offering, and is outside of the normal 9-month operation of Letters and Science, mm-hmm. that it was a better fit administratively with us rather than Letters and Science.
Howard, I have a question about the 4-week session. In a 4-week session, if I'm an undergraduate and say I want to take Introductory German or Art History 101 or something, is the whole semester taught in those 4 weeks? And what do you think of the... Is the quality of what's taught in 4 weeks generally equivalent to a regular semester?
Well, you're asking a question that has been debated for nigh on a century.
I'm sorry.
And it's a question that I faced a lot of times, and in fact, since it comes up so frequently, And as new folks come on the block and start to question it, I go back to the literature. And in fact, there is a time, I can't remember, it was probably in the early 90s, that I got my dander up because people were questioning the validity of concentrated summer sessions, mm-hmm. or intensive courses. That I launched a study, and there was an article published on how students performed in intensive courses. There was also a dissertation published by a Patricia Scott at Madison that did extensive research to show that overall the performance of the students on the same exam in the summertime as they would get in the fall or spring was equivalent, if not better. And intensive courses, there is an attempt as far as possible to try to cover the same amount of material. Mm-hmm. And for instance, in foreign languages, since you mentioned that, the classes are meeting multiple hours on every day of the week, 5 days a week, whereas in the regular year, they're meeting 3 times a week, mm-hmm. or possibly 4. So it's conceivable, and it's very likely, that the number of hours, instructional hours, that they receive in a 4-week course is equivalent. Mm. Madison campus has always been very, very, and particularly faculty committees have always have been very, very conservative in giving out more than a credit a week for very intensive studies, unless it meets the number of hours. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they've also been conservative in how many courses they allow people to take in the summer, because it's very grueling. It's almost impossible with the number of hours to take two foreign language courses in the summer, mm-hmm. because of the intensity of the instruction. The literature nationwide indicates that the quality of the courses and the performance of the students and the retention of the information is as good as, if not better, than in the regular year. Mm-hmm. But it's a question that is raised.
So Howard, to pick it up, we were on summer school and the assessment of the intellectual quality of it. Particularly, I was focused on the 4-week session.
Well, the question, even. This this last year, the summer session organization meetings around the nation, the question still comes up. Of course, often it's because the new directors of summer session at a lot of universities are more or less fresh out of school and are facing an entire new career and a whole new set of issues that they haven't faced before, so they don't have the experience. But it is an age old question, and there are still questions. I still got questions in my latter years at work from other universities about the viability of shorter sessions. And in fact, probably 2 years ago, I applied for a research grant, and with the cooperation of an academic staff member on the Madison campus, did a research of all of the literature as far back as we could go, and wrote a rather lengthy paper showing that the literature clearly shows that 4-week sessions and 8-week sessions are rewarding experiences for the summer for students. 4-week sessions have the weakness of not being able to do equivalent work in the areas of, say, organic chemistry or advanced mathematics courses. They fit better into the 8-week sessions. But in the 4-week sessions, most of the subjects, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, can be taught effectively with significant learning results for the student.
Are term papers assigned in 4-week sessions?
I can't speak generally or specifically about that. In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. Mm-hmm. But they're not always required in the academic years either. Mm-hmm. In the academic year.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious.
No, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know how faculty and instructional staff taught their courses. I didn't delve into on the Madison campus. Mm-hmm.
You're ready. Mm-hmm. So, what do you think about the future of summer school education?
Well, I would hope that the Madison campus would stay with the model that it has had, because one, it has been so steady. Its enrollments for decades have been very, very, very steady. In fact, some of the steadiest in the entire country. I know there have been some rumblings on taking away GPR support from summer and putting it on a program revenue basis. I hope that does not become the case, which it has become at many other universities. But one, those universities don't have the same balanced curriculum. Only courses that make money or make a profit are offered, not those that necessarily serve the needs of the students or serve the curricular plans of the department. Other universities running program revenue-based summer sessions do not pay faculty at anywhere near the same rate. Their pay is far lower. The quality of the instructional staff, the faculty in the summer, is nowhere on a par with that at Madison. They hire community people or graduate students, and to me, it's a clear case. It's not broken, so we don't need to fix it.
Howard, if I am an undergraduate whose home is in Madison, but I attend college, say, elsewhere in the United States, how difficult is it for me to enroll in summer school at Madison?
I don't think there are any difficulties at all. In fact, some universities rely on people returning to that community to get enrollments in their summer sessions. Mm-hmm. But as long as one is not going to try to matriculate from Madison, but just to take an extra course in order to serve a degree requirement elsewhere, the mechanism is in place. That's why there's an office, the Adult and Student Services Office. Mm-hmm. In the summer sessions, well, in the Office of Continuing Studies. Mm-hmm. It was formerly known as the Office of Special and Guest Students, and guest students in itself suggests that, mm-hmm. That we are serving people who are here for short periods of time. That actually brings up another change that took place in the tenure of these two, of the Division of University Outreach and the Division of Summer Sessions and Inter-College Programs. There was also further growth from the Office of Outreach Development was first transferred the what was called the Program Information Office, which was an office providing publicity and communicating about all the continuing education, formerly extension activities of the campus. And then later on, the Adult Counseling, Career and Educational Counseling Center, which had been originally headed by Peg Geisler and then by two other people, culminating with Liza Monroe as head of that. That was also merged with the Division of Continuing Studies. And we undertook to merge the Office of Special and Guest Students and the Adult Career and Educational Counseling because they did reach out to adult students and to special groups to merge them under one leadership to make them more efficient and more focused on serving our non-traditional audience. And what culminated was the creation of the Adult and Student Services Office, and its first director was Assistant Dean Pat Fessenden. It's now headed by Judith Strand.
Howard, a question that occurs to me is, what was the nature of your relationship as Dean of Continuing Studies to the other four-year campuses in Wisconsin? Were you all working on things together, or was there no relationship?
There is a relationship, it's manifested in the what's known as the System-Wide Continuing Education Council. University of Wisconsin Extension, one of its divisions, the Division of Outreach, Continuing Education, and E-Learning, more or less coordinates this meeting. And on that committee is a representative of each of the member institutions of UW system. So the Dean of Outreach, or whatever it's called at UW-Milwaukee, serves on it. The people all have all kinds of different titles: director, assistant, vice chancellor, what have you, from all the people with the central responsibility on all the other campuses meet on a regular basis, several times a year, most times all but once in Madison, usually at the Wisconsin Center, right on Langdon Street. One to two-day meetings. talking about the continuing education activities of the different universities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Howard, I want to ask you to turn your attention to the whole issue of long distance learning and its evolution and your assessment of its strengths and weaknesses in the time period that you were responsible for it.
Well, once again, the University of Wisconsin has a long tradition of being involved in what these days is called distance education. And of course, one could go back to the fact that apparently UW-Madison was the first to have a radio, educational radio station, which delivered educational materials to the people of the state. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in the early 19th century, the UW-Madison developed a very strong correspondence study program in foreign languages, in mathematics, in a good number of fields. And after the University of Chicago decided to drop its correspondence study program, I can't remember the name of the leader of the University of Chicago, I think it was William Harper or something like that, negotiated with Madison for Madison to assume that responsibility. Mm-hmm. So way back, long before my time, Madison had a strong commitment in correspondence education and in educational radio. And that continued to grow, and when the United States Armed Forces Institute was located in Madison, providing correspondence courses to American troops all over the world, the university was its partner and its deliverer in those courses. And it's when I was a graduate student that I first became involved in this, in that in order to supplement the TA-ship, which is around $2,300 in 1965, I was grading paper, instructing service personnel through the Armed Forces Institute, and also through the correspondence division of the university. There were several in the correspondence program of the university, courses for credit in a vast number of fields. A lot of, English, psychology, mathematics, chemistry, German, French, you name it. Those courses were thriving, and there were 14, 15,000 students enrolled for credit in those courses throughout the entire U.S. and in foreign countries. Instructional manuals in Portuguese, for learning of Portuguese, were developed at Madison and were being used in American schools in Brazil, for example. Mm. at the same time, after the Second World War, Madison became the extension division of then the university became involved in educational telephone. And the University of Wisconsin was seen as in the vanguard, the right at the very front, at the top of the vanguard in offering courses over the radio, with the development of the educational telephone network. And I don't recall in what years, but also Madison became involved in slow scan television courses for delivering educational programs, particularly in engineering and related fields. Mm-hmm. So Madison, through its different extension connections, has been heavily involved in distance education through its various forms for a very long time, and as I suggested, was indeed at the forefront. Mm-hmm. Educational television, telephone network now has been replaced by more advanced things, but it still is used in some cases, and is run under the auspices of University Extension, but is still used by some of the Madison Outreach units. It's interesting to note that when the Open University was founded in Britain, one of the advisors for the creation of that was the person who had headed the Correspondence Study Division of UW-Madison, Charles Wedemeyer. One also could note that our educational television network back in the 60s was seen as being the creme de la creme, and was visited by the person who was to become the first vice chancellor of the Open University in Britain, a Canadian whose name skips my mind at this present time. So there's a long tradition, and that tradition has been kept going, and evidence seems to indicate that distance education and use of computers and electronic equipment is increasing as we speak.
Now, Howard, if I live outstate, say I live in Rice Lake or Spooner or something, how do I get into one of those courses? Do I have to apply for it, or is it available to the?
There are some distance education courses, for instance, delivered through WHATV and the ECB, the combination, that are delivered at certain times over the air. But in order to get credit from these courses, one has to enroll. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, one enrolls through UW Extension. In other cases, one enrolls through the local campus, or even through UW Madison. But there are there's an increasing number of, let's say, e-learning, electronic learning possibilities. Or opportunities, rather, around the state.
Mm-hmm. Howard, I remember now the question I wanted to ask when we were talking about your relations with other outreach programs from the other four-year campuses. When one thinks about the difficulty that UW-Madison has with state legislators, how it would seem to me that people in the state have really benefited from the Division of Continuing Studies, and also from the work of UW Extension. Has there ever been anything put into place to tap the service that was provided in a way to that would be influential with the state legislature?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. You ask if something's been provided?
Well, UW-Madison often seems to be on the receiving end of a lot of criticism from the legislature as being an elite or exclusive institution, when in fact what you've been talking about, in fact your whole career, has been how the university has been reaching out to the people of the state. And it's, sometimes it seems to me there's not a connection between the service that is provided and the recognition that the state legislature perhaps ought to be giving to the university.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of information available about what the campus does. I mean, in terms of continuing education, over 130,000 students are reached a year. Mm-hmm. And the majority of those students are adults. And but I think a lot of the criticism that is aimed at what most people are concerned with, and that is the undergraduate population, the youth. Mm-hmm. And it's probably extreme on my part to say this, but the group that's most likely to squawk are the parents of the students who can't get into university, and that's where the legislature focuses attention. Mm-hmm. As on the accessibility of the youth of the state, the graduating youth, graduating from high school youth, and getting into the university. I mean, there's no question about it that individual legislators are going to know the value of what the College of Engineering does for the engineering companies in its area. The social service agencies are going to know what the UW-Madison campus does for the training of its social service workers. But that's not the area where the complaints are coming from. Mm-hmm. There is also the issue that when one gets outside of Madison, people don't necessarily differentiate between UW-Madison and UW-Extension. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm not sure they differentiate between the or among the different universities. My feeling is that if a service is being provided, it's being provided by the university, and nobody really questions which particular university or arm of the university. Mm-hmm. You know, so the good work that is done does not necessarily redound directly to UW-Madison itself. Mm-hmm. But rather goes to this entity in people's mind of the university.
Mm-hmm. Howard, you were beginning to address the fundamental issue as you see it at the university.
I think in the last year or so, there's grown a concern that the university was in a sense university-centric and had lost sight of its mission of being the land-grant institution of the state of Wisconsin. For seven to nine decades, the Wisconsin idea was observed and practiced to a great extent. And then with the merger of the system, of the two university systems and the creation of UW Extension, sight was lost of that land-grant mission, and the university moved closer and closer to becoming a research institution primarily, and the result was less interest, it seems to me, in carrying out the Wisconsin idea. However, in the last few years, there's been a realization that the strengthening of our commitment to the Wisconsin idea, it has to be a high priority, and that also the research research preeminence must be maintained, which is also part of the land grant institution mission to do research. So I think the discussion and the struggle to strengthen the Wisconsin idea to return more closely to the land grant mission is a challenge that the university will face in the future.
Howard, are you optimistic for the University of Wisconsin as you look down the decades ahead?
Yes, I think it will be a mainstay of the University of Wisconsin system. I think there'll be several changes. I don't know what those changes are or will be, but I think there is a climate where people are willing to take a look at things and consider different ways of operating, different structural organizations. And will continue, even though it'll have its struggles economically, to be one of the top world universities.
Thanks for the mention. This now concludes the oral history interview with the distinguished and accomplished Howard Martin. Thank you, Howard.
Welcome.